Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. All right, I've been looking forward to it. I know you have too. Some of the fans have responded. This will be kind of a good show for them. No kinda about it. We're gonna climb into the crazies. This mountain range, this sort of like island range. We all know it and love it. We drive by it, big timber, and we're fascinated by it. I am anyway. There's a real world kind of range war that happened in Big Timber, Montana. Story of a wind farm that ignited conflict over land, heritage, power, money, the future of the American West. It's all there in this story, the crazies, the cattleman, the wind prospector, and a war out west. And from the Wall Street Journal, Amy Gammerman, author of this great story, joins us today on Voices of Montana. There's a lot to it here, a lot of names you're going to recognize as well. And the story behind it really is a modern kind of range war, a clash between these fifth generation ranchers or generational ranchers that were looking at wind, the potential for wind and the crazies to help with the farming operations and save the land, actually, as the Jarretts would say about it too. And of course, that area has attracted a lot of rich and powerful landowners, and they have their own ideas about how this land and their private property rights should be adjudicated. Amy Gammerman joins us again, who wrote this story. Amy, I'm so glad to have you on. Simon & Schuster published it. I'm just going to go out and say, if you haven't thought about a Christmas gift yet, this is going to be a good one right out there. Really an engaging story. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be talking with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. And I really am just a blank here with a lot of questions, but I just want you to tell the story to kind of start with. And I framed it a little bit, but why don't you frame it as it developed, you know, when you started it? And honestly, there's a lot of research. I can see all that in there, a lot of good sources cited as well. But I'm always curious about when you started this story and when it ended and what that baby looked like.
Yeah. So this all came about. How does a nice Jewish girl from Connecticut end up in the crazy mountains in the middle of a modern day range war? So I stumbled into this story. I write for the Wall Street Journal's real estate section, which is called Mansion, not entirely tongue in cheek. It's about the homes and the lifestyles of very wealthy people. And I was writing a profile of a Texas oil and gas billionaire who collects beautiful ranches. He collects ranches the way other rich men collect art or thoroughbred racehorses. And we were doing a piece on his ranch collection. I was visiting a few of his ranches with him, and his ranch in the crazy mountains of Montana is the absolute crown jewel of his collection, his favorite ranch. He loves this ranch. It reaches from the Yellowstone River right up into the mountains. It's gorgeous. It's huge. It was a record-setting land buy when he bought it. He put together seven different ranches for this amazing property. And we were touring it together and walking around and taking in the amazing views. And the billionaire mentioned that the rancher just over his border to the south wanted to lease his land for a wind farm. And his whole face clouded over. And he was talking about how terrible this was going to be. And it was going to ruin the beautiful views. And it was going to kill all the birds he loves to hunt. And just generally wreck his gorgeous ranch. And I asked him, kind of joking, but really not joking, well, you know, why don't you buy this guy out? And he said, I've tried, and the man is not interested. He is set on doing that wind farm. And even though this had absolutely nothing to do with the story that I was in Montana to report on and write, it just stayed with me. I would find myself thinking months later, you know, well, first of all, what is it like to say no to someone with so much money and power, a man who's not used to hearing the word no? And who is the stubborn rancher? And whatever happened with his wind farm? Like, did he build it? And about, I don't know, a year or so later, just on a random internet trawl, I stumbled across a news item in a local newspaper about a lawsuit that was brewing in the Crazy Mountains of Montana. And it was over a proposed wind development. A couple of old ranchers, generational ranchers, wanted to lease their land for wind development, and their neighbors had joined forces to stop them. And their neighbors included some of the richest people in America, among them my Texas oil and gas billionaire. And I just became kind of obsessed with the story from that point on, and that's how it all began.
And then you started talking to the Jarretts, or the Andersons, or the person who kind of really stands out in the book is Marty Wilde as well, this wind prospector. Mm-hmm. And then another narrative began to kind of form as well. I like that question. You know, what's it like to say no? What was your answer to that? What was Rick's? And go ahead and mention these names, because they are long time ranchers.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, so the man at the heart of this book is Rick Jarrett. He was a fifth generation cattle rancher. His ancestors had arrived in Montana on covered wagons. You know, they were the classic pioneer story. His great 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 grandfather was one of the last people to travel the Bozeman Trail before it was finally shut down. And he had been ranching on this piece of land, as his ancestors had, his whole life. And his one goal in life was to ensure that this ranch, which had gotten smaller with each generation, because any of your listeners who work in ag and work as ranchers know, it's a very hard business to sustain over time. His one goal was to ensure that this land would be there for his grandkids, so that they also could ranch, they could run cows, and they could continue the lifestyle that he loved so much. And it was just, he was constantly looking for ways to ensure the future of this place. He tried everything. You know, he raised pheasants on his ranch and advertised it as a game bird preserve. He hosted working ranch vacations for rich tourists to come and stay on his ranch and follow him around as he did all of his chores and his, you know, irrigating and tending his herd. He did everything he could think of and was still so deep in the red, you know, had mortgaged the place to the hilt. And it wasn't through lack of hard work or trying. It's just the cattle business is tough. So he and his neighbor, who is an old rancher, now in his mid-90s, named Alfred Anderson, came up with this idea of leasing their land for some wind turbines, for wind development. And they met this wind prospector named Marty Wilde, who completely lived up to his name. This guy was a wild character. It was like an incarnation of the old gold prospectors who once flooded into Montana, except instead of panning for his gold in a stream, he was searching for his gold in the air. He was always going around and like searching out the best wind. And as you know, or you may know, Montana has some of the best wind in the United States of America for wind development. So this guy, Marty, was always looking for projects that he could develop and then flip to some big international, you know, renewable energy development company.
That is quite an actual endeavor as well, as you relate in this book. And he's probably one of my favorite characters because he had a never say die kind of attitude about things. And he says, well, you're going to stop me here, I'm going to go over there kind of deal.
Oh, Tom, you so nailed it. That was him. That was Marty. Like Marty, one of his girlfriends, these guys, both Rick and Marty, had a lot of girlfriends.
And you mentioned that. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
They were birds of a feather. These were men of a certain age, single men of a certain age, who behaved the way men of a certain generation and a certain age sometimes do. There once was a strip club place called Shotgun Willie's, which some of your listeners may remember. Rick had a reputation for spending some time at Shotgun Willie's in his day, and I once asked a colleague of Marty's, do you think Marty and Rick ever went to Shotgun Willie's together? And he's like, is the sky blue? So these were two wild guys. Yep. They were, but very hardworking. And yeah. Marty was, he was a never say die. You know, if you told him no, you know, plan A is not going to work and plan B isn't going to work, he'd go to plan C. And if plan C didn't work, he'd go to D or E or F. This guy was always looking for an angle. And he wasn't always the most scrupulous practitioner in the ways he would go about things. One former colleague of his said, you know, we used to say in the wind business, when you shake hands with Marty Wilde, check your fingers. So these are some very colorful people, and they are all kind of, you know, nobody all good, nobody all bad, all just extremely complicated, colorful, just this amazing cast of larger-than-life characters who just sort of leapt off of real life into some other realm for me. I was just so fascinated by everybody that was part of the story.
Yeah, and you did a great job of letting them tell their story and you know, keeping away from any kind of advocacy about it. You let the story tell the story itself. Amy Gamerman is with us here, author of The Crazies, The Cattleman, The Wind Prospector, and A War Out West by Simon & Schuster. I'm thinking Christmas time coming up here, too, because it's full of the kinds of conflicts that, you know, we encounter every day. Rick Jarrett, Marty Wilde, and then Gordy, the Texas oil billionaire. You know, they encounter these kinds of clashes on a regular basis. And so I'm fascinated, too, as to how you got to understand their characters. And maybe you talk about that, Amy, because the way you write, and I really appreciate the writing, too, you know, you go ahead and dive into what they were thinking or what they may be thinking. And that doesn't happen unless you have a pretty good understanding and spend a lot of time with these people.
Well, thank you for saying that, Tom. It was really important to me. You know, the thing that jumped out at me, like from the get-go, was that this wasn't really a conflict about wind development so much as it was a story about what it means to love the land. Because every single person involved in this bitter, bitter conflict really loved the place that they were fighting for. And just what they saw when they looked at that place and what they valued about it was different for each one of them. So I understood, or I thought at the beginning, what was really going to be critical was to understand what each person was seeing when they looked at these crazy mountains and to kind of get at what had drawn them there and why, you know, what it meant to them and what they were fighting to preserve. And, you know, with these wealthy neighbors of Rick and Alfred's, you know, they had been drawn to this place because they thought it was really so beautiful and such a special landscape. You know, Russell Gordy had this line. He said, you know, they don't make land like that anymore. It's precious. You know, once a landscape like this is gone, it's gone forever and you can't ever replace it. And they really valued that about the crazies and about Big Timber. And so my goal was really to spend as much time with each person as I could and, you know, to kind of listen to them and read things they had written and really get a sense of where they were coming from and why it mattered so much.
And you do that by going into the history as well. I like how you folded in, you know, Russell Gordy's history, or you didn't waste, you know, space when you talked about Rick Jarrett's history there as well. It really helped paint the story.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think in Montana in particular, you really can't understand the present without understanding the history of the place and a little bit about what has gotten everybody there, right? So getting those histories and understanding the unique life stories that each person brought with them, that was really important to me. And you know, Russell Gordy is a very wealthy man, but he came from very little. Mm-hmm. You know, he grew up poor and he lost his father at a very young age, a lot like Rick did. Actually, their life stories have a lot in common. And, you know, beautiful land came to mean something very profound to him. He developed this love of land on his grandparents' farm in Louisiana, and it was something that always stayed with him. You know, he wanted to have this, and he wanted to create some beautiful place for his own family. So it was very meaningful to him. You know, it wasn't just an investment or something.
It is a very involved story, Amy. And Amy, you were kind of ready for this. I mean, a longtime Wall Street Journal reporter. You like, as you mentioned, real estate. You also cover culture in a lot of ways. So it wouldn't be the first time you dug into property records or looked at land transfers and and things like that. And this is not a what year was this? We're talking the late 90s.
Well, the fight over the wind farm went back quite a ways. But the lawsuit unfolded in 2019.
Yeah.
And then kind of continued on. There was a long kind of afterlife of it that went on while I was reporting the book. I began reporting on this in late 2019, and it took me about 5 years.
Yeah, to get, and you finally got it across the finish line. It's about a year now out there.
It came out in early January, so we're coming up on a year.
So tell me how you view this story then, because there's a lot of angles on it here. You got privatization versus public access. You're obviously talking about wind energy. People have thoughts about that. I have a lot of them myself. We've covered a lot of news here. Tribal rights and recognition also fold into this story.
Yes, there are so many strands to it. The longer I looked at this story, the more I saw that it wasn't just about one small wind project. It was about a lot of things, and it involved a lot of different interests in the New West, kind of the New West bumping up against the Old West. But I think, like, for all of that, there's one strand that runs through it all, and it's about being a good neighbor. You know, and what it means to be a neighbor in this day and age. And in the rural West, Rick's daughter, Jamie, has this line that she says that really stays with me. Jamie says, in the rural West, neighbor isn't who you are, it's what you do for each other. And to neighbor each other is like a verb, you know, like how can we be good neighbors to each other? And in a rural community like Big Timber, you know, everyone is so independent and self-reliant and resourceful, but you really do depend on your neighbors, and your neighbors are going to come out and help you when, you know, there's a wildfire that starts, you know, tearing through your land, or, you know, you suffer an illness in your family, your neighbors show up. And to me, this book really touched on what happened when big money flooded into a traditional ranching community and began kind of altering that dynamic of neighbor to neighbor.
Yeah, and that saga still goes on because there's been a land exchange in that area. The checkerboard nature of the crazies had been a focus as well. And now some of those billionaires versus millionaires, they're buying water from communities to feed a golf course. And
yes.
And so so you look at the progression of that and you go, well, I don't know how you stop that or how everybody tries to get a little piece of something that they love when this is in front of them.
Yes. And you know, the Crazy Mountains are such an interesting case of this because you have all of this private land in the Crazies that's kind of in a checkerboard pattern with public land. And this goes way back to the days when the railroad was coming through the West. And this was how they enticed the railroad to build and lay track through the West, was they would grant the railroad sections of private land. And this land was eventually sold. And so now you have these incredibly beautiful mountains that people want to get into and hike in and, you know, just fish and hunt. And the public land in them is often blocked by these trophy ranches that have amassed tons of acreage up there. You know, you have people who own mountains. Before I wrote this book, I didn't know it was possible to own a mountain mm-hmm. in America. But yes, you can. And plenty of people do own mountains, and they can keep other people off them if they want. So in the Crazies in particular, you have this real tension between, you know, the sense that this should be a landscape for everybody to enjoy, but it's kind of locked up behind gates in some cases, and you can't get to it. And you also have some very wealthy people who are infringing on their neighbors' water rights with things like, I don't know, the building a giant golf course as this new ranch that is owned by the same outfit that owns the Yellowstone Club, which some of your listeners may be familiar with.
Sure.
This is a new ranch property that they've developed on what was once known as the Marlboro Ranch. It was where Marlboro's cigarette company would, you know, bring its most loyal customers for little ranch getaways. Well, this has now become a real luxury retreat, and they have this beautiful golf course. And in the arid West, you know, keeping a golf course nice and green is a challenge. So they began trucking in water from Big Timber to keep it watered and using their water rights in ways that weren't entirely legal to keep it irrigated. So, yeah, you have all of these interesting conflicts that are brewing. And it all goes back to the history of the land and how it got carved up between public and private.
Don't know if we have enough time to fully explore this. Got 2 minutes left here. But as you talked about, it's clear everybody loved the land. Everybody was, you know, all in on what they were doing. And when I got done reading the book without giving up too much, it was hard to pick winners and losers in it. It's a story about people. And so that comes with degree. The winning and the losing. Do you have a winner? Do you have a loser in this?
It's such a hard question. You know, I don't like the term loser because it's so pejorative. You know, as a culture, we're all about the winners, right? And like, if you're not a winner, it's not just too bad. It's also kind of shameful. And I feel like the deck was stacked against these traditional longtime ranching families in a way that wasn't fair.
Yeah.
And to call them losers just puts an extra bitter spin on it that I really don't like. I just think that it wasn't a fair fight in the end. But I don't want to give away too much, and I want people to go and read the book and enjoy it and, you know, see where it takes them. But I will just say that, you know, when you have extreme wealth pouring into a community or a conflict, it alters the dynamics in such a profound way. That, you know, the normal rules don't always apply.
I think that's a great way to leave that one as well. Real life story, a lot of intricacies in it as well, a lot of different angles to explore. Amy Gammerman is with us. She spent a couple of decades with the Wall Street Journal and authored this book, The Crazies, The Cattleman, The Wind Prospector, and A War Out West. And it really is. It's about land and power, and there's tribal sovereignty here, the billionaires, the ranchers, and the future of the American West. It's all in there, Amy. I don't know you. And thanks for being here. I appreciate that. Kind of, as you said, kind of fell into it a little bit and then really produced a story that informs us all. There's a lot of names. The Jarretts, the Andersons, Marty Wilde. You wrote about a lot of people. The Chesnovs, again, some of the billionaires, the McMillans, the Cargill fortune. And so even Monica Trinnell is, you know, somebody who was we've interviewed here in her run for the Western District congressional race. So it's all in there in so many ways. I'm curious as to, you know, who's your favorite character, or who did you like writing about most, or even who was it a struggle to write about?
Wow. Well, you can't ask me who my favorite was. That's like asking me who my favorite child is.
I can ask you, but you don't have to answer.
Okay. Well, you know, here's the thing. I go into the stories, the life stories of each one of these main principal characters. And as I was writing each chapter, I would kind of fall in love with each one of them a little bit and be seduced by them, even when I wasn't always approving of what they did or necessarily admiring their behavior. These guys, all of them, Monica, Marty, Rick, Russell Gordy, they're all kind of larger than life people and just really captivating. So each one of them really kind of would win me over in turn. And the challenge was to just sort of stay grounded and not make judgments and not pigeonhole people or stereotype them in any way.
Yeah. And again, you did a really good job of that. I mean, I'm sure there was a temptation to advocate one way or another. Or maybe it wasn't for you. Maybe you recognized to get Amy out of the way in this story, so to speak.
That's the goal. You know, getting Amy out of the way is a really good thing to do because I'm not an advocate. I'm not an activist. I'm not a politician. I'm not a lawyer. I have one thing I know how to do, and that's to tell a story. And I just wanted to tell this story in a way that would do honor to each of the people who was in it. And not to impose my judgments on them too much, just to, as much as it was possible, to let each person speak for themselves.
Well, it had an impact as well. And I think about the Crow tribe, the Crow Nation has, they have some a long heritage of connection to the land there.
Yes.
And it wasn't necessarily being recognized, but I think maybe, I don't know you if you would take credit for it or not. You probably don't.
No, I wouldn't.
But they got more aggressive in their advocacy to ensure those rights or to preserve their culture. And they have that now in some of these agreements. But talk about that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I was fortunate enough to meet and get to know Shane Doyle, who is an educator, an advocate, an enrolled Crow tribal member who has just worked in so many ways to fight for the environment of Montana and also to affirm the Crow tribe's connection to the Crazy Mountains. And this became such an important part of the story for me because the Crow tribe, this whole area, the Crazies, Big Timber, this was all once Crow country. And the Crazy Mountains had a tremendous importance, a cultural and spiritual significance to the Crow people. Because if you're a young person and you wanted to prove yourself to your community, what you would do is you would climb up into the Crazy Mountains and you would build a bed of rocks on the highest peak, and you would take off all your clothes and you would lie on this bed of rocks and you would go without food and water for days, waiting to be visited by a dream, like a great vision. The Crazies were a literal dreamscape. It was a place to go and receive power from another realm. And then you would take this back down with you, down from the mountain, and use whatever insight you'd gotten to help your community. So access to the Crazy Mountains continues to be a really important thing for Crow people, even long after they were pushed off this land and onto a reservation that's about 200 miles to the east. So Shane Doyle has done many things. But part of his work is to ensure access to the Crazies for Crow tribal members and also to protect the Crazies from development and, from seeing things like, I don't know, heliskiing operations going on there and building going on there and cell phone towers. That's been a really important cause for him. And, when we talk about this connection, this enduring connection to the Crazy Mountains, if we have time, I'll tell you a little bit of a story that really brought it home for me, which was the story of the Clovis child.
Yes.
This was a child who lived more than 13,000 years ago. His skeleton was found in the side of a cliff, buried with all kinds of stone artifacts, spear points and axe handles and all kinds of things. And this child had been someone very, very important to his tribe. And he was discovered back in the 60s. Somebody was doing some construction work and was scooping talus out of a cliffside. And this cliff, as it happens, points directly at the Crazy Mountains. It faces the Crazy Mountains. It's in Wilsall. And what was discovered was that the bones of this child were ultimately analyzed. A forensic DNA analysis was done. And what was found was that the DNA of this child, whose people had been among the first people to be in Montana after the ice sheets receded in the last great ice age, this child was related to something like 80% of all Native American people on both continents, North and South. This geneticist said to me, I'm a scientist, we never use language like this, but if you were ever going to say this child was Adam, then this is it. He was the Adam of the Americas. This kid was related to, he was the ancestor of so many indigenous people. And where did his people choose to bury this extraordinary child almost 14,000 years ago? They buried him in a cliffside facing the Crazy Mountains. And when I stood on this site, I looked at those crazies and I realized that as the sun rose up in the east every morning, this spot, this child's burial place, would be the first thing the sun's rays would touch every day for eternity. And a shiver went through me because I thought, well, gosh, no wonder everyone feels so strongly about this place. It has an otherworldly pull, and it endures to this day.
Really glad that you included that and told that story here too, because boy, it's one of those things that just, it's happenstance in a way, right?
Yeah.
But it was so vital. There is so so much connected to it as well.
Yes.
Really cool when you can run into that when you're writing a book, huh?
Absolutely. And it also made me realize that this was no ordinary place. You know, Montana is a special place. It is a treasure state. There is something unique and wonderful about places like Big Timber and the Crazy Mountains. And, you know, that is something that maybe is valuable, not just to the few who happen to own land there, but, you know, it's kind of like part of our national birthright. Our heritage as Americans are these exceptional, amazing places.
I agree. And so that's why the conflict is so interesting, because everybody has a legitimate right to their feelings about this too.
Yes.
Some may be not so legitimate in other people's eyes, but nonetheless, there's those degrees again. Amy Gannerman is with us. I got a text message. I don't think it comes from your publisher, but it's basically, where can I buy the book? And thanks so much. Simon & Schuster, the publisher, on it as well. And the full title is, I've been giving it here too, because it's pretty cool. Amy Gannerman, it's The Crazies, The Cattleman, The Wind Prospector, and War Out West. Where do you send them?
Oh my gosh! Well, you can go on Amazon, but you can also go to your local bookstore and ask there. And if they don't have the book, I'm sure they'll be glad to order it for you. Montana has some of the best independent bookstores in the country.
Yeah.
It was the honor of a lifetime back in March and April to do a book tour through the state, and I was able to visit some of these stores. And wow, Montana is a place where people really love books and care about reading and ideas. And it was such a great experience for me to spend time there.
We're going to take a break here now and talk more about Montana. We'll have just a little bit of time to wrap up here, but your most unforgettable interview or your most Montana moment. You said you were a Jersey girl coming out here.
Connecticut.
Sorry. Oops. Oh, almost ended the interview right there. I'll never be able to drive between Billings and Bozeman, where my family, some of my family members live, and see the Crazies without knowing a lot more than I did before about it. Thanks to Amy Gammerman. She's the author of The Crazies, The Cattleman, The Wind Prospector, and A War Out West. There are so many things to talk about here. Marty probably ended up being my favorite character, and I know you wouldn't want to have a favorite child in this regard, but give me an idea of I'll go with this one first. This most Montana moment, when you recognize, and I apologize profusely on the air now, not Jersey, Connecticut girl. when did Montana become real to you as a Connecticut girl?
Oh my gosh, yes. Native New Yorker, moved to Connecticut. Yes, thank you for that clarification, Tom. Yeah, you know, there was so much I didn't know about the West, really. And, you know, it was little things like, you know, when you're on someone's ranch, if you open a gate, you better close that gate, you know, or you're going to let a lot of cows out. And, you know, if you're walking in high grass, you know, best to be wearing boots because there might be a snake in it somewhere. But mainly the thing that I really learned was just how tough ranching is, the whole how hard it is to work in ag. I came away with so much respect and understanding of just how much work people do, how self-reliant they are, how uncomplaining they are, how resourceful they are. One day I was driving with Rick. Rick had some health setbacks, and his daughter Jamie had said to me, Rick wanted to show me the old homestead that his great-great-great-grandfather had settled. And it's up way up there in the mountains. And Jamie had said, look, whatever you do, don't let Dad drive because he's not doing so well right now. And I said, okay, I'll drive. And it was one of my first trips to Montana. So I had rented like a little economy car.
Oh, no.
Not knowing. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, not understanding that you can only drive, you know, you need four-wheel drive. And here I am in my little Japanese import. And we're driving up and it's mud season and we get stuck in the mud. And we are like on a very narrow dirt road on the side of a mountain, and my wheels are spinning, and I look at Rick, and I'm like, can we call AAA? And Rick says, I think you better let me drive. And I said, I think you're right. I think you're right, Rick. And we got out and switched places, and did Rick get us out of that mud pile and off the side of that mountain and down that road again safely? Yes, he did, and he probably could have done it in his sleep. So, it, you know, it's things like that. It's just people don't ask for help. And yet if a neighbor needs help, they are there without being asked. That to me was like the big timber ethos. And, you know, it really had a very profound effect on me because I just hadn't really thought about ranching and, you know, it just seemed like a kind of picturesque lifestyle. I really didn't understand how much goes into it.
That's a great story to end on, Amy. I don't have much time for anything else. I'm just going to say there's another story out here, and it's part of this as well. The West is changing. COVID had a lot to do with that, but it was changing anyway. And we're still struggling with the new West. The old West is still struggling with what the new West is going to look like. Those development pressures on our landowners, they're real. I mean, and they can pull out of all the debt that they have and end up actually sitting pretty by selling their land, but then the land is no longer in the family. I don't know. There's no question in that. And there's only 30 seconds left here. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. It's been an honor and a great privilege. Thank you so much for having me.
You I don't have you. 20 seconds is not enough to go into that. But Amy, I'm going to invite you back, okay? If you're willing.
Oh, anytime. And to all of you in Montana, really happy holidays. Happy New Year. I'm with you in spirit, and I love you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.